Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 16th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and I'll be reading local news and tri-state news. We'll begin with the Journal Editorial Board mini-editorial. The Journal Board writes, "Congratulations to Dort University and Northwestern College for qualifying Monday for the NAIA Volleyball Playoffs. The 48-team tournament begins Saturday with an opening round at campus sites. 24 teams will advance to Sioux City for the final rounds, which start November 30th at the Tyson Events Center." And again, this was written by the Journal Editorial Board. And now we move to a brief recap of the 5-day forecast for this area. And so today has a predicted high of 71 with some cloudiness. And the low this evening will be 37. Wednesday will become windier and colder with a high of 48 and a low of 24. Thursday will be breezy with plenty of sun with a high of 40 and a low of 23. Friday will also be breezy and a little bit milder with some sun, a high of 49 and a low of 31. And Saturday will be increasing clouds with a high of 54 and a low of 28. Our first story headline is Council okays removal of 3 Hamilton Boulevard traffic signals. And this story was written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. The Sioux City Council authorized the permanent removal of traffic signals Monday at 3 locations along Hamilton Boulevard, West 3rd, West 8th, and West 22nd Street. The council voted 3-2, with Mayor Bob Scott and Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore voting against the removal of Hamilton Boulevard and West 3rd Street. The vote was unanimous to take out the traffic signal of Hamilton Boulevard and West 8th Street. Scott cast the lone no vote on the removal at Hamilton Boulevard and West 22nd Street. "Listen," Mayor Bob Scott said before the vote, "I like how it goes through now. I still think there's at least one too many stoplights in this corridor. I don't know how we can justify leaving the one out there when you got 4 turnoffs to get into the marketplace. How many do you need?" Mayor Bob Scott said before the vote. Burns and McDonald, an engineering firm, was contracted to evaluate signal warrants at 5 intersections on Hamilton Boulevard and conduct a public outreach campaign along the corridor. The firm found that West 3rd, West 8th, and West 22nd Streets did not satisfy the Federal Highway Administration's minimum criteria. West 17th Street and the Center Plaza entrance at Marketplace were not recommended to proceed to the testing phase, as they met current traffic signal warrants established by the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. During the first 30 days of the 90-day study, the signals were placed in flash mode and stop signs were placed on side street approaches. After 30 days, the signals were turned off completely for 60 days. Nearly 80% of the online survey respondents indicated that traffic flow improved or remained about the same after the signal was taken out of service at West 3rd Street. More than 90% of respondents and 67% of respondents came to identical conclusions after signals were removed at West 8th and West 22nd Streets. Mark Tuck, a civil engineer for Burns and McDonald, told the council that removing the 3 signals will move traffic better, in a safe manner, with less delays and less stops. "That's really the intent of removing the signals. It's not to penalize or punish any individual business. It's not to punish or penalize any individual residents. It's to provide a safe solution to move traffic through the corridor," he said. No crashes were reported at either West 3rd or West 8th Streets during the evaluation period. There was one rear-end crash involving a northbound vehicle on Hamilton Boulevard turning right onto 22nd Street. However, if the traffic signal was in service, it would not have prevented the crash, according to the study. "Are we not obligated to make our streets as safe as we can? If we know, based on this study, that we can prevent traffic accidents and prevent injuries and prevent fatalities, don't we want to take a serious look at this?" Councilman Pete Gretkin said. Scott noted that he doesn't like pulling out at West 22nd Street because he said the line of sight is horrible. During the meeting, a couple residents spoke out against the proposed removal of the signal at West 3rd Street and the geometric modifications that would go along with it. The study found that the risk for increased crashes would be reduced if access at 3rd Street was restricted to right-in, right-out only, meaning a median along Hamilton Boulevard would need to be constructed at 3rd Street to eliminate the through and left-turn movement on 3rd Street. Additionally, the median would eliminate the left-turn movements from Hamilton Boulevard to 3rd Street. Pat Tomczka, executive director of the Siouxland Center for Active Generations, said motorists are taking a shortcut through the center's front parking lot, which is just 6 feet from its door. The center is located at 313 Cook Street between West 3rd and West 4th. I agree that safety is important, but when you take the public safety off the streets and put it into our parking lot, you really have to take a second look at it, Tomczka said. We might have someone that's 85 that's coming out that door and not looking, and that person's driving away. If that safety goes away, we've caused an accident there. Burns and McDonald will now proceed with the next phase of the project, which involves developing timing patterns based on signal spacing and updated traffic counts. Our next headline is Casino Startup Price in Nebraska, $1 million. Companies that want to open a casino at a Nebraska horse racetrack will have to pony up $1 million for a license. That's one of the requirements of the rules released Friday afternoon by the Nebraska Racing and Gaming Commission. The 67-page document lays out everything from license applications to how to handle the money to how to deal with problem gambling and sex trafficking. Included are two provisions that are likely to make some people happy and others unhappy. All casinos will be smoke-free, and no one other than the law enforcement officers or licensed security guards will be allowed to carry firearms. Racing and Gaming Executive Director Tom Sage said the proposed regulations are a hodgepodge of best practices from casino regulators across the Midwest. The commission hired Gaming Labs International, an industry consultant that has worked with other states, including Ohio, to help it write rules for casino gaming. They basically took what worked in some of those other states and incorporated it into our rules, Sage said. The $1 million fee to be paid up front would secure a license for 20 years. Casinos also would face an annual assessment to help fund the activities of the commission. Sage said details of the annual assessment still have to be worked out, but it likely would be based on how many gaming machines and table game spots a casino has, meaning larger operations would pay more than smaller ones. People involved with casinos also will have to be individually licensed, including all vendors and key operators. Vendors face an initial licensing fee of up to $5,000 for a 3-year license and an annual fee of up to $2,000. Key persons would face application fees ranging from $10,000 to $15,000. While the startup costs seem steep, they are actually low compared to some other states. Iowa, for example, sets initial application fees for racetrack casinos based on the size of the county where the casino will operate. It ranges from $5 million for a county with a population of 15,000 or less to $20 million for a county with at least 100,000 people. Among other states, Virginia requires a $15 million fee for a 10-year license for any type of casino, while Pennsylvania requires horse track casinos to pay $1.5 million every 5 years. In Nebraska, the $1 million initial fee and the 20-year license were included in the language of the petition circulated ahead of the November 2020 vote that authorized casino gambling at the state's licensed horse tracks. In May, the legislature approved a framework for casino gambling, and the Racing and Gaming Commission has spent several months coming up with the proposed rules. The commission will hold a public hearing on the rules on December 17th, and assuming it votes to approve them, they will be forwarded to the governor and attorney general for review. Once signed off on, they will go to the Secretary of State's office for official recognition. All 6 licensed horse tracks in Lincoln, Omaha, South Sioux City, Columbus, Grand Island, and Hastings have announced plans to add casinos. Plans at Lincoln Racecourse call for a $220 million project that would include more than 1,200 gaming stations, a 196-room hotel, event space, several restaurants, and other amenities such as a spa. Lynn McNally, Executive Vice President of the Nebraska Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, which is partnering with Ho-Chunk, Inc. to build casinos in Lincoln, Omaha, and South Sioux City under the War Horse name, said the rules are very thorough, especially when it comes to security and the background check process. "I'm very pleased with the way they worked out," McNally said. "The Racing Commission worked efficiently and diligently, and we really appreciate their efforts." In addition to the 6 existing tracks, there also have been proposals announced for new tracks in Bellevue, Gearing, Kimball, Norfolk, North Platte, and York, all of which are likely to seek casino licenses as well. Global Gaming Nebraska, a subsidiary of the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma, hopes to operate casinos at the existing track in Hastings and propose new tracks in North Platte and Gearing. Its president, Sean Boyd, said in a statement that the company is thankful for the opportunity to work with the Nebraska Racing and Gaming Commission towards strict and integral regulation of gaming within the state. Sage said any proposed new tracks will have to go through the racetrack license application process first and be approved before they can apply for a casino license. Fauna Park CEO Chris Cadillac said he's concerned about new operators opening racetracks simply so they can open a casino. He said with no limit on the number of horse tracks in the state, there's a risk of market oversaturation, especially considering the state's population. "There's not the human or equine infrastructure in place to support any more racing than we already have," he said. McNally expressed concern too, but said there are new federal laws going into effect that will make it more expensive for horse track operators. She also pointed out that the proposed gaming regulations make clear that any casino operator must have an active track license, which could discourage any operator that's not dedicated to horse racing. Sage said the Racing and Gaming Commission currently does not have the authority to set limits on the number of casinos it approves, nor can it consider proximity to other operations in its decisions whether to grant a license. Publishing the rules was a first step, but it remains unclear how long it will be before anyone can play a slot machine in Nebraska. Once the license is approved, Warhorse officials have said they will put up a temporary casino at Lincoln Racecourse while construction begins on the resort complex. Construction alone could take 18 to 24 months. Woman accused of damaging firefighters' vehicles. A Sioux City woman was arrested early Saturday and charged with causing thousands of dollars of damage to vehicles parked at a Sioux City fire station. According to court documents, firefighters at the station at 2633rd Street heard a car alarm going off in their parking lot at 6:53 a.m. When they went outside to check the alarm, they found Dominique Carmen in the lot damaging the vehicles. Damage included broken windows and scratches and dents on vehicle doors, roofs, hoods, and quarter panels. Damage is estimated at approximately $11,000 to 7 vehicles. Police called to the scene found Carmen inside one of the vehicles. She is also suspected of breaking the windshield and windows in a car parked outside a house in the 2500 block of First Street earlier that morning, causing about $1,000 in damage. Carmen, 27, was booked into the Woodbury County Jail on charges of first-degree criminal mischief and third-degree criminal mischief. Sioux City man pleads not guilty in sex abuse case. A Sioux City man has pleaded not guilty of having sexual contact with a girl. Bobby Schlosser, 23, entered his written plea Monday in Woodbury County District Court to one count of third-degree sexual abuse. He remains in custody in the Woodbury County Jail on a $20,000 bond. According to court documents, Schlosser touched and had sexual contact with the girl on June 26 in a bedroom of his Sioux City home while the girl was watching a movie. Schlosser pretended to fall asleep, then began touching the girl, who was age 13 or younger, while his eyes were closed. He later removed the girl's shirt and underwear and got on top of her, continuing to assault her. The girl jumped over him and left the home when Schlosser changed position. She reported the incident to her mother, who took her to the hospital and called police. Schlosser sent messages to the girl asking her not to tell anyone what had happened, court documents said. Siouxland man sought by Fugitive Task Force. The U.S. Marshal Service Northern Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person: Brent Kelleher, 38. He is 5 feet 11 inches tall and weighs 190 pounds. Kaler is wanted on a warrant issued in Woodbury County for parole violation. He is on parole for felony drug conviction. Anyone with information can contact the U.S. Marshal Service at 712-252-0211 or by emailing siouxland.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. We have another Nebraska story. The headline is for Representative Fortenberry, a two-sided challenge in 2022. When he seeks office again in 2022, U.S. Representative Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska will essentially face two opponents, a progressive Democrat with a lot of support in the state's second largest city, and a federal prosecutor in California who has accused him of lying to the FBI. The nine-term Republican has always coasted to the re-election in his GOP stronghold district, an expanse of rolling farmland and small towns with left-leaning Lincoln in the middle. Now he's running with a federal indictment over his head and the prospect of a conviction that could send him to prison and cost him benefits he receives in office. He's also likely to face State Senator Patty Pansing Brooks, a Democrat with a strong fundraising background who is well-known in Lincoln. Pansing Brooks announced her candidacy for Congress on Monday, pitching herself as a results-focused candidate who would push for better phone and internet service in rural areas and lower prescription drug costs. She is the only Democratic candidate to announce. No question, it's going to be a tough race, but I'm just going to do the best I can, Pansing Brooks said in an interview. I have an ability to make friends on all sides of the aisle. Her campaign is still a long shot, based on both history and Republican dominance in the district. Other Democrats who showed promise at the outset of their campaigns have ended up losing to Fortenberry. Still, prominent Democrats are hopeful that, with the indictment and a newly drawn congressional district, they might have a chance to unseat Fortenberry. He's been wounded by the scandal, and I think Patty will have a very well-funded top-drawer campaign, said Dennis Crawford, a Lincoln attorney who challenged Fortenberry unsuccessfully in 2014. It's still a heavy lift and would require an upset, but the chance is still there. Crawford said the district is difficult for Democrats because so much of it is rural and Republican-leaning, which offsets the party's advantage in Lincoln. He said that also made it tough to raise money because the district is widely seen as unwinnable. Pansy Brooks won her legislative seat twice in a heavily Democratic Lincoln district, but is ineligible to run again because of term limits. She pointed to her leadership experience in several major fundraising initiatives, including a $9.6 million push to redevelop Lincoln Centennial Mall, a $6 million Union Plaza fundraiser in the city, and a successful $250 million Lincoln Public Schools bond issue. Fortenberry has more than $897,000 in cash on hand for his campaign, according to the Federal Elections Commission, and stepped up his fundraising around the time prosecutors announced charges against him. The district remained GOP-friendly after lawmakers redrew the state's political boundaries earlier this year, but less so with the addition of Democratic-leaning areas of Bellevue, an Omaha suburb. The district also lost Republican-heavy Saunders County to the much more competitive 2nd Congressional District. Fortenberry also faces the prospect that more information about his case will trickle out during the campaign, giving his opponents ammunition to use against him. His trial in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles likely won't take place until February at the earliest. Fortenberry was accused last month of lying to the FBI and concealing information from agents about an investigation into illegal campaign donations from a Nigerian billionaire. He has pleaded not guilty. Despite the charges, many prominent Nebraska Republicans have publicly maintained their support. Governor Pete Ricketts defended Fortenberry on Monday as a man of integrity and said he found the allegations difficult to believe, but acknowledged that it could make it tougher for the congressman to win election. I think it does present an additional challenge for Congressman Fortenberry, but again, he's got to go through this process with regards to the courts, Ricketts said. In a statement, Nebraska Democratic Party Chairwoman Jane Cleave praised Pansy Brooks for her work in the legislature to help vulnerable children and said she will restore dignity to the office and bring her full heart to get work done for the people of Nebraska. Pansy Brooks has been a vocal champion of LGBT rights, but also worked with conservatives on legislation aimed at sex trafficking and Native American issues. She kicked off her campaign Monday with a tour of the district, where she planned to speak about the need to upgrade bridges and roads. She said most Nebraskans don't live in a partisan prism and want to see legislation that improves their lives. Things have become so partisan, and I think that's where Patty will have a real advantage, said Senator John McAllister, a Republican who has frequently clashed with his party and who appeared in Patsy Brooks' campaign announcement video. She's able to bridge the gaps like nobody I know. And so, if it can be done, Patty Pansy Brooks will make it happen. We now have a story from South Dakota, and the headline is South Dakota Legislature Moves for Subpoenas on NOAA Meeting. South Dakota lawmakers moved Monday to subpoena a document and a former state employee at the center of questions about whether Governor Kristi Noem used her influence to aid her daughter's application for a real estate appraiser license. The legislature's Government Operations and Audit Committee is pressing for details about a meeting the governor called last year that included her daughter, Cassidy Peters, and key decision makers in a government agency that had moved days earlier to deny Peters' application for an upgrade to her appraiser certification. The Republican governor, who has positioned herself for a 2024 White House bid, has adamantly denied any wrongdoing. But the subpoenas, which both cleared the GOP-dominated committee Monday on 8-2 votes, show lawmakers want more answers on an episode that has drawn criticism from government ethics experts. The subpoenas, however, are not finalized. They must also be approved by the ranking legislative committee, the executive board, which meets Wednesday. The Government Operations and Audit Committee has the ability to examine government records, but Noem's administration had refused to hand over a document that could prove whether a plan was in place to give Peters another chance to win a real estate appraiser license before last year's meeting. The Department of Labor and Regulation has argued that administrative procedure bars them from divulging documents that are derogatory to people. Secretary of Labor Marsha Holtman, who was part of last year's meeting in the governor's mansion, has told lawmakers that was mostly a policy discussion and it did not impact Peters' application process because state regulators had already formed an agreement with Peters to fix issues with her application. Noem has backed up that account, although the governor contended that the agreement with her daughter was not even broached during the meeting. I believe a key piece of the issue is the timing of the agreement between the appraiser certification program and Cassidy Peters, said Republican Senator David Wheeler. Secretary Holtman said an agreement has already been made before the meeting at the residence. I simply want to confirm that. Lawmakers also want to hear from the former director of the program, Sherry Brenn. She was called into the July 2020 meeting and was later pressured to retire shortly after Peters received her license that November. Brenn filed an age discrimination complaint and received a $200,000 payment from the state to withdraw the complaint and leave her job this year. Noem has said the settlement had nothing to do with her daughter. The committee had requested Brenn's presence last month, but she declined. Part of her settlement with the state bars her from disparaging state officials. However, Brenn told the Associated Press that she would work with the lawmakers to correct any factual inaccuracies in Holtman's testimony to the committee and indicated to lawmakers that she would like to receive a subpoena to appeal before them in person. Republican lawmakers spoke with caution as they inquired into an episode that has drawn open derision from Noem. She has repeatedly berated the AP for first reporting on the meeting with her daughter. But Wheeler insisted the committee was acting within its role of checking up on the operations of state government, adding that it is appropriate to clear the air on what actually happened. Other Republicans said they would rather wait to see if the Government Accountability Board, a separate ethics committee of four retired judges, takes up the issue. The state's Republican Attorney General has asked it to take a look at the episode, but it is unclear if that board will take it up. Republican Senator Wayne Steinhauer suggested a defense for the governor as he voted against both subpoenas. If you've got somebody that's got actual experience working with the program, involving them in a meeting seems to be appropriate, he said. Optics, when it is a family member, politically maybe aren't the best, but I just got to try and figure out where we're headed with this. Our next headline is OSHA Smithfield settle coronavirus complaint. Federal workplace safety regulators announced Monday that they have reached an agreement with Smithfield Foods to settle a contested citation of the company's coronavirus safety measures during a massive outbreak last year at a South Dakota pork processing plant. Under the agreement, Virginia-based Smithfield Foods will develop a plan to prevent infectious diseases at meatpacking plants nationwide and pay a $13,500 fine. Smithfield Sioux Falls plant was one of the nation's worst COVID-19 hotspots during the early days of the pandemic. By June 16, 2020, four workers were dead and nearly 1,300 had tested positive for the virus, according to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. After an investigation, the federal agency said Smithfield did not do enough to space workers out or provide other safety measures such as face coverings or physical barriers. However, the company contested that assessment and defended its actions at a time when safety precautions against COVID-19 were not clear. Smithfield spokesman Jim Monroe said the company admitted no wrongdoing and called OSHA's allegations baseless. Settling with OSHA and avoiding litigation allows Smithfield to continue the good relations it has with the agency as we have the shared goal of workplace safety. The United Food and Commercial Workers had previously derided the $13,500 fine as a slap on the wrist. Employees at the plant have said Smithfield did not do enough last year to prevent infections in the plant, where workers labored elbow to elbow as they processed nearly 5% of the country's pork. The union at the plant has said that it has been attempting to negotiate for more coronavirus protections leading up to the outbreak. After cases kept accumulating, Smithfield shuttered its plant for nearly 3 weeks. Smithfield has agreed to work with third-party experts to develop a new plan to prevent diseases from spreading in plants, which will include an assessment of medical safety measures from meatpacking plants administration on down to personal protective equipment for workers on butchering lines. Smithfield has agreed to work with third-party experts to develop a new plan to prevent diseases from spreading in the plants. Oh, this is just an exact duplicate of the paragraph I just read. Okay. Smithfield already had a prevention plan in the works and is now focusing on vaccinating its entire workforce against COVID-19. OSHA's regional administrator, Jennifer Rouse, warned that a comprehensive plan was necessary. What happened at this facility was tragic, and we must ensure that all steps in the agreement are followed to prevent a mass outbreak from happening again, she said. Our next headline is Iowa spent $12.3 billion in federal funds. The state of Iowa spent about $12.3 billion in federal funds in fiscal 2020 that represented about a $3 billion increase, much of which was tied to the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, according to an audit issued Monday by State Auditor Rob Sand. Sand said about $2.3 billion of the 32.7% spike in federal aid that state received during the 2020 fiscal year came from the CARES Act, while changes in non-CARES and non-loan programs included an increase of about $518 million in funding for Medicaid expenditures. Expenditures directly related to the CARES program, according to the 96-page audit released on Monday, included $1.4 billion in additional unemployment insurance, $605 million from the Coronavirus Relief Fund, $97 million for the Educational Stabilization Fund program, $56 million in CARES-related supplemental school breakfast and lunch programs. Expenditures for programs not related to CARES included $4 billion for Medicaid, $1.4 billion in capitalization grants for clean water state revolving funds, $598 million for highway planning and construction, $491 million for unemployment insurance, $482 million for capitalization grants for drinking state revolving funds, according to the report. While state officials administered about 600 federal programs during the year ended June 30, 2020, a total of five programs accounted for about 70% of total federal expenditures not related to CARES. In his audit, the Democratic state auditor reported 9 internal control deficiencies and 3 instances of noncompliance at various state agencies within Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' administration, including $448,449 in unsupported salaries paid within the governor's office from the Coronavirus Relief Fund. According to Sand's report, the control deficiencies he cited address issues such as lack of policies and procedures to ensure variances are identified and corrected, ways various reports are reviewed and approved, including all the proper information submitted to the federal government before the due date, and ensuring all required information is included. In addition, he said there were three noncompliance findings addressing questioned costs of $113,000 paid to incarcerated individuals, $124,000 in payments to deceased individuals for unemployment insurance, and $448,000 in unsupported salaries paid from the Corona Relief Fund. He provided the state agencies with recommendations to address each of the findings. The governor had a budget shortfall. She had too many people on her personal staff and didn't have big enough money to pay them all. So instead of addressing either the budget that she had or the number of staff she had, she decided to use CARES Money Act instead, as Sand said in an interview. We warned her back in October that it would be difficult having her office salaries qualify as a CARES Act usage and gave her specific directions how to make it most likely to qualify. He noted that requests for documentations were not provided, and he expected federal overseers may request that some of the federal money not used for pandemic-related functions be returned. Alex Murphy, Reynolds Communication Director, issued a response Monday saying the U.S. Department of the Treasury confirmed that the use of coronavirus relief funds to reimburse the salaries and benefits of a governor's staff is an allowable expense. During this time, the governor's staff spent a vast majority of their time responding to the pandemic. In fact, many members of Governor Reynolds' staff work 7 days a week out of the State Emergency Operations Center to provide direct support to Iowans. This has always been our justification for the expense, said Murphy. We are now working with Treasury to provide them documentation per their request. A copy of the state's auditor's report can be reviewed online at auditor.iowa.gov/reports/audit-reports. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 16th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Readings Information Service for the Blind. Normally at this time we would go to obituaries, but there are no obituaries in today's paper. Our next story headline is Iowa Corn Bean Harvest Nearly Complete. The first snowflakes fell last week, but with 97% of the soybean crop combined and less than 10% of the corn crop still in the field, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig says the prospects are for completing the harvest look good. Variable precipitation slowed field work in parts of Iowa, but allowed farmers 4.1 days suitable for harvesting, baling corn stalks, applying fertilizer and anhydrous ammonia, and fall tillage during the week ending November 14, according to the USDA. Farmers have harvested 91% of corn for grain, which is 4 days ahead of the 5-year average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain was 17%. Farmers in South Central Iowa have over 20% of their corn for grain yet to harvest. In some places, cattle have been put out to graze on corn stalks. The soybean harvest is virtually complete at 97%. Although precipitation helped improve soil moisture levels slightly, topsoil moisture levels rated 1% very short, 10% short, 81% adequate, and 88% surplus. Subsoil moisture levels rated 6% very short, 25% short, 66% adequate, and 3% surplus. Multiple weather systems brought measurable rain along with the first snowfall of the season across portions of Iowa. The system produced a broad shield of moderate rainfall with a broad swath over the state's middle third, reporting heavy rainfall. 70 stations measured an inch or more, with most stations receiving at least 1/2 inch. A gauge near Cheriton observed 2 inches, while Allerton reported 2.98 inches, with the statewide average at 0.86. Weekly precipitation totals ranged from 1/10 inch at Rock Valley to 2.98 inches in Allerton. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 0.93 inches, while the normal is 0.46. Iowa also experienced warmer than average temperatures, even with a late week cold snap. A few stations reported low 70s with a statewide average high of 66 degrees, 16 degrees above normal. The statewide average temperature was 42.7 degrees, 5.5 degrees above normal. Shenandoah reported the week's high temperature of 72 degrees, November 7th, 18 degrees above normal. Forest City reported the weekly's low temperature of 20 degrees, November 13th, 5 degrees below normal. Despite these warmer-than-average temperatures, several stations reported a trace of snow, and more than 25 stations observed at least 1/10 inch. Forest City measured 1 inch of snow. Nebraska officials urged adoption of foster children. Nebraska officials, including Governor Pete Ricketts, put out a call Monday for people to adopt foster children as the numbers have declined during the pandemic. State officials said there have been 304 adoptions so far this year and 360 in 2020. But in each of the preceding 5 years, Nebraska logged more than 500 adoptions. Ricketts said Nebraska currently has 646 children who are waiting to be adopted, and we want to encourage those families that are thinking about adoption to do that. On Monday, he signed a proclamation of November as Adoption Awareness Month. Stephanie Beasley, director of the state's Child and Family Services Division, said adoption helps connect kids to loving families that provide them with a foundation of support and a sense of belonging. We'll now move to the sports section, and we have a college volleyball story, which was referenced earlier in the mini editorial. The headline is Northwestern Dort Volleyball Qualify for NAIA National Tournament. The Red Raiders and the Defenders are going dancing. Monday afternoon, the Northwestern College and the Dort University volleyball teams received word that they still have a shot at the NAIA national title. Both Sioux County squads were given at-large bids for the NAIA Women's Volleyball National Championship Tournament, the majority of which will be played at Tyson Events Center in late November and early December. The 48-team tournament includes 36 automatic qualifiers who earned their spots by being either a regular season champion or runner-up, a conference tournament title winner or runner-up, or a conference selection. The remaining 12 teams in the tournament were picked by the NAIA Selection Committee. The Great Plains Athletic Conference, or GPAC, will send 7 teams to the tournament, the most of any conference in the country. In addition to Northwestern and Dort, the GPAC will send the College of St. Mary of Nebraska, Concordia, Dakota Wesleyan, Jamestown, and Midland, Nebraska to the event. This year's tournament will begin with an opening round play on November 20th at various campus sites before resuming on November 30th in Sioux City. The first 2 days of play at the Tyson Events Center will be pool play, with the top team in each pool advancing to the elimination rounds on December 2nd. The tournament semifinals are set for December 3rd, while the national championship will be played at 7 p.m. on December 4th in Sioux City, while also airing on ESPN3. Dort will host Bethel in the opening round this Saturday at 1 p.m., while Northwestern will host IU Kokomo, Indiana, at 8 p.m., since the Red Raiders basketball teams play a basketball doubleheader. We'll now move to an entertainment story, and the headline is Seasonal Spirits, Giving Classic Holiday Cocktails a Modern Spin. And this is written by Earl Horlick. A neighbor once gave Chef Michael Gazaway a book of drink recipes. The book, originally published in the early 1960s, was full of cocktail ideas for a country that still enjoyed a meat and potatoes diet, watched the Ed Sullivan Show every Sunday night, and shared a JFK level of optimism about America. This was a time when real madmen and their wives would dress up and entertain friends and family at their homes, Gazaway, a culinary arts instructor at Western Iowa Tech Community College, explained. I could almost picture guys in skinny ties when I looked through the book of cocktails. The book inspired Gazaway to teach Holiday Cocktails, an Institute for Lifelong Learning class with beverage guru Czar Templin. For many people, the holidays start at home, Gazaway said. The foods and the drinks that we crave aren't necessarily of our generation. Instead, they are the ones we remember our parents or even our grandparents making every year. He has a point. We love our pot roasts, pumpkin pies, and turkeys with all the trimmings because they reflect a nostalgia which becomes more personal every Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Day. And it is also true for the special drinks of the season. Whether it's eggnog, wassail, or hot-buttered rum, the holidays feel more jolly with such throwback drinks. We want to feel warm and toasty on a cold winter's night, Gazaway said. A holiday drink can do the trick like nothing else. However, both Gazaway and Templin wanted to recreate some classic cocktails while giving them a more contemporary spin. For instance, Gazaway has created a sweet Irish cocoa drink made with Bailey's Irish Cream, a butterscotch schnapps, and get this, a bunch of multicolored mini marshmallows. Yep, this is a hot chocolate that is suitable for the over 21 crowd. Who doesn't like hot cocoa in the wintertime, Gazaway noted. This drink makes everyone feel like a kid again. Except the Baileys and the schnapps can make you feel snockered. Gin and tonic Gin and tonic lovers may enjoy the winter wonderland, which is made with gin, lime juice, and rosemary simple syrup. Gasway gives a drink an appropriate holiday-friendly twist by adding fresh berries and a swig of rosemary to the cocktail. "We eat with our eyes, but we also drink with our eyes," he said. "Adding something green and red makes this drink feel a whole lot like Christmas." Just as tasty is Gasway's takeaway on a fireside cocktail. Made with whiskey, cinnamon, and a walnut simple syrup, he adds orange peel slices and a cinnamon stick to make it more festive. "People immediately look to the past when they think about the holidays," Gasway said. "We bring back the traditions of our families while hoping to add a few things of our own." Which was why Gasway was drawn to his neighbor's cocktail book in the first place. "We may no longer have much of a cocktail culture, and we certainly don't dress up the same way our parents did," he said. "But the holidays are a perfect time to look back at a more innocent time in our history." And going along with that story is a little sidebar that says, things you need to know about holiday drinks. And so wassail, which is spelled W-A-S-S-A-I-L. What is it? It's just another name for a hot mulled cider. But before you ask, to mull something means adding spices like cinnamon, clove, and allspice while heating up the cider. You steep the spice and then get rid of it. And how long has it been around? A very long time. Shakespeare even referred to wassail in Hamlet. And then a fun fact. You know that standard Christmas card, "Here we go a caroling"? Well, it was originally called "Here we go a wassailing," which makes sense since we associate the drink with carolers. And then eggnog. What is it? It is made with milk, eggs, sugar, cream, and sometimes liquor. Eggnog is actually one word, not two. Why didn't we know that before now? And then how long has it been around? Milk punches, which is essentially what eggnog is, has been wedding whistles at least since the 17th century. Legend has it that George Washington served eggnog-like drinks with rye whiskey, rum, and sherry to visitors. And then a fun fact. Ever have a warm Tom and Jerry Christmas punch? It was not named after the animated cat and mouse duo. In fact, the origin was attributed to British writer back in the 1820s. And then hot buttered rum. What is it? A mixed drink made with rum, butter, cider, and spices. How is it different than a hot toddy? Well, a toddy is made with whiskey, not rum. Plus, a toddy isn't as rich tasting as hot buttered rum, since it doesn't use butter. And then how long has it been around? At least the mid-19th century. Hot buttered rum had another burst of popularity as a tiki drink, popular in the 1940s. And then a fun fact. Mark it on your calendar because Hot Buttered Rum Day is celebrated on January 17th. And then we move to the Siouxland Strange section of the Weekender magazine. And it says here, a Sioux City man was arrested during the early morning hours November 5th after he followed a woman, propositioned her, then assaulted and robbed her, then burglarized several cars. At around 9:11 p.m. November 4th, 48-year-old G. Mann, listed as a transient of Sioux City in some court documents and a resident of Louisville, Kentucky in others, began following a woman who was walking home from Sam's Mini Mart at 923 West 7th Street. When Mann reached her, he asked if he could pay her for sex, and she refused, according to the criminal complaint. He then grabbed the victim by her hair, assaulted her multiple times in the face, and stole her smartphone. The string of car burglaries began shortly thereafter. On West 17th Street, a man observed Mann inside his unlocked parked vehicle shuffling through it. When the man approached him, he took off on foot. On West 5th Street, a man went outside and heard the sound of his car door being shut and noticed the interior light was on. Nothing appeared to be missing, but the victim noticed the vehicle had been rummaged through and papers from the glove box were scattered on the seat. At least two other vehicles on West 5th Street were found to have been similarly broken into and rifled through, according to criminal complaints. After midnight, officers located Mann in a backyard in the 400 block of Prescott Street. He exhibited signs of intoxication but refused a preliminary breath test. He was found with stolen property, including the woman's phone and property that belonged to another person. He admitted to stealing it forcibly from the woman. He was arrested and faces charges including 4 counts of third-degree burglary, motor vehicle, an aggravated misdemeanor, fifth-degree theft, a simple misdemeanor, public intoxication, a simple misdemeanor, and second-degree robbery, a Class C felony. He was held in the Woodbury County Jail on $18,600 bond. We'll now move to another story who is not exactly a local story, but it is an interesting story about a bank robbery in 1969. And the headline is, Man Lived Quiet Life After 1969 Bank Heist. Before Thomas Randall sold luxury cars and taught golf in suburban Boston, before he got married and had a family, federal marshals say he was Theodore John Conrad, who pulled off one of the biggest bank robberies in Cleveland's history. The suspect's disappearance was a mystery that lasted 52 years, a few months longer than he did. Conrad was a 20-year-old bank teller at the Society National Bank in Cleveland when he walked out at the end of his workday on a Friday in 1969 with a paper bag containing $215,000. That's the equivalent of more than $1.7 million in 2021 dollars. The theft wasn't discovered until a few days later, and Conrad was never seen again. Authorities said Conrad had become obsessed a year earlier with the 1968 film The Thomas Crown Affair, starring Steve McQueen, about a bank robbery for sport by a millionaire businessman. Conrad told friends that taking money from the bank would be easy, even indicating plans to do so. In the years since, the case was featured on shows like America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries, and investigators chased leads all over the country. Federal marshals said Friday that marshals from Cleveland went to Boston last week and confirmed that Conrad had been living an unassuming life since 1970. He had been living under the name Thomas Randall in a Boston suburb close to where the original Thomas Crown Affair movie was filmed. The U.S. Marshals Service of the Northern District of Ohio said investigators matched documents Conrad completed in the 1960s with documents Randall completed, including a 2014 bankruptcy filing in Boston. And additional investigative information led marshals to positively identifying Thomas Randall as Theodore J. Conrad. Thomas Randall died of lung cancer in May in Lynnfield, Massachusetts, using the date of birth as July 10, 1947. His real date of birth was July 10, 1949, and Conrad would have been 71 at the time of his death. U.S. Attorney Peter Elliott said his father, a career deputy U.S. Marshal in Cleveland from 1969 until his retirement in 1990, never stopped searching for Conrad and always wanted closure up until his death in 2020. Elliott said documents his father unearthed from Conrad's college days helped with the identification, but he would not say exactly how he found out about Randall. I hope my father is resting a little easier today, knowing his investigation and his United States Marshal Services brought closure to this decades-long mystery, he said in a statement. Everything in real life doesn't always end like in the movies. Cleveland.com reported that Randall had a family, became a local golf pro, and sold luxury cars, and was a fixture in a small town. An obituary said he got married in 1982, and they had one child together. And now we'll move to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I recently backed out of an adoption. I feel terrible about it. How can I mentally and emotionally get over it? My baby girl is 4 months old now, and my guilt is getting worse. I backed out 3 days before she was born. The couple I had chosen turned out to be unprofessional and emotionally unstable. They not only caused me several problems, but also my job, which I loved. During the 4 months I knew them, they treated me poorly, and I realized it was better for my little one not to go through the adoption. They are now trying to make me out to be a bad person who used them financially, something I really did not. I'm glad now that I kept my daughter, so why do I keep feeling so bad about my decision? Signed, guilt-ridden in the Midwest. And Abby responds, if I had to guess the reason, I would say it may be because you know your last-minute change of mind caused this couple pain. A way to assuage your guilt might be to work out a payment plan so they are not out the money they spent. The lawyer or agency that arranged the adoption may be able to guide you. Our next letter. Dear Abby, I have 2 sisters. We are very close until our mother passed away 2 years ago. In her trust, the proceeds from the sale of her house were to be divided among the 3 of us. Only one sister has children, and they are grown. My two sisters have decided we should split the proceeds from Mom's house, about $800,000, five ways, to include the adult children. Their mother has threatened to disown me if I don't go along with the five-way split. I have always done right by her kids, and neither sister bothered to ask for my reason for not wanting to include my nephew or niece in the inheritance. I love my sisters, and I do not want to lose them, but I also do not want to be bullied into a decision I cannot support. Signed, to divide or not to divide. And Abby responds, your mother's wishes were that the money be divided three ways. Your sister should abide by the directions of the trust. I agree you should not be bullied or threatened into taking less than your mother wanted you to have. If your sisters want the kids to have a share of the inheritance, they should gift the amount from their portion rather than extort it from you. Their attitude has not only tarnished something that should have been a blessing, but also created a rift in the family, and that's a shame. And then, dear Abby, I could really use your help. I don't know how to respond to people I hardly know who end conversations with, I love you. I don't feel comfortable saying that to someone and not meaning it. This isn't like saying, have a nice day. Is there a polite way of responding without saying something that to me is totally inappropriate to someone I only have a casual relationship with? Signed, Uncomfortable in the Midwest. And Abby responds, respond this way. What a sweet thing to say, thank you. Then smile and fade out. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 16th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.